Well, I now introduce my friend Joe Perry, who has for many years been a statistician involved in ecology and agriculture at the Rothamsted Experiment Station, one of our longest founded, I think, government research centres. Joe, isn't that right? Maybe even the oldest, I think, possibly. It doesn't apply to all its workers, though. So, Joe, biotech crops.
Thanks. The reason I put this 3:30 on the screen is not to remind me of what time it is. It has to do with the chap on the left who's a worker in the vineyard. And, of course, in the parable, you'll recall that some workers were recruited at the ninth hour, which seems pretty late. It's about 3 o'clock. And I'm one of them. Because I was born of a Jewish mother and a married non-Jewish father. So my mother tried to look after me, and for various reasons she couldn't. So she had me fostered by a Christian lady who took me to church. So I went to church until I was about 5. And then I was adopted by Jewish parents and circumcised and went to Hebrew classes and had a bar mitzvah. And then decided I couldn't actually see the point in the Jewish religion. And so for many years I was agnostic. And not really until I was a fairly mature adult was I converted to Christianity. And then I did begin to see the point of the Jewish religion. However, of course, if you listen to people like Richard Dawkins, you would imagine that people who convert might even lose their intelligence. Some of these quotes would have you believe. So I'm a great example of an experiment that could be done by Dawkins to look at my production of papers in the refereed journals and to say, well, when was it, in looking at this series, when would you say it was that I converted and put you out of your agony? It was then, so I think you can agree there's a small but statistically significant increase in my production since I followed Jesus. So I'm going to talk about plant biotechnology. Traditional plant breeding crosses randomly many thousands of genes within a species. Molecular biotechnology takes a single gene, usually, and puts it into a species, sometimes a different species. Before we get on to the frontiers, a brief resume. So here are the crops that are commonly grown. In the US, you'd call this canola. We call it oilseed rape. We call it maize. You call it corn. We call it tomato. You call it tomato. And the traits. What sort of traits are introduced into these crops? Well, this is a major one in which Bacillus thuringiensis, a toxin against Lepidoptera, is taken and placed into a crop plant, in this case cotton, it can be maize, and it's selective, so it just kills the moth pests, other moths too. And what we found is, for example in China, this has led to a huge reduction in pesticide application and a real reduction in deaths. But in China too, there are locally produced systems. It's not just the big companies. And it's used by many millions of small farmers, not just the big farmers. This, I think, is important, and we'll return to this. Another major GM trait is tolerance to particular broad-spectrum herbicides. Growth started in about 1996 in North America. You'll notice that it's rising just as fast now in developing countries as it is in developed countries. Sorry, I'll just go back. Yeah. You'll also notice that although it's prevalent in North America, it's not going on much in Europe. The European consumers largely rejected GM technology in the late 1990s. And we'll look at the reasons behind that later, because it is important. We in Europe have decisions to make. Of course, this is our view of the US situation. It's not my view, but there we are. Okay. So now I've been asked to look at the frontiers. Now, that's not just the biochemical new traits, not just the scientific frontiers, but the important questions for the future. And what is the most important question for the future? And I think it's this one. Our food has been getting cheaper, so it had a huge effect socially since World War II. Is this always going to be the case? I don't think it is, for many reasons, and we'll look at some of these. Climate change. Locally, we have had floods recently. We've had them in France. This is beginning to push up the price of grain. So we have local effects of climate change caused by the increased variability of our weather. We have regional effects too. And here is the prediction for the movement of the North American wheat belt. And you can see it's going north and it's shrinking. And I think in general, it's thought that climate change will not be advantageous for agriculture. This was part of a news item, and this map, and the news item is actually on the left, and although it's irrelevant to this debate, I do want to emphasise that there is someone in it who comes from a publicly funded research institute in a developing country, Kenya, and he's saying, we in the developing countries are dealing with a crisis situation. We may need to use GM to address that. Climate change may bring a dependence on biofuels. I'm going to digress now and just ask the question, biofuels, is there a future for GM with biofuels? And according to evidence given to our Parliament, yes, there might be both for current crops and for future crops. But what about the effect of biofuels on food availability? The problem here is twofold. First of all, there are plans within the UK for bioethanol plants that are actually going to use wheat to fuel them. Seems to me crazy, but it is certainly going to have an important effect on the domestic wheat market. And more generally, if we are going to devote some of our agriculture to biofuel crops instead of food crops, that's going to increase food prices. We can already see that this is actually having an effect on wheat prices, which rose last year for the first time in many years, and are set to rise by a further 50%, we believe, this year. The other thing you can see from this Ministry of Agriculture within the UK graph is that the volume of production is not going up greatly. And this is reflected in this slide, which shows the worldwide annual production. Yes, we had a big increase around the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s during the Green Revolution. This increase mediated by new plant breeding, conventional plant breeding techniques, and by herbicides and fungicides. But that increase has plateaued out during the 1990s. So if we are going to get a big increase in food production, we're going to have to look elsewhere than conventional agriculture for it. And of course, oil is used, and oil is running out, oil is used for fertiliser, pesticide, for our fuel for tractors, and for distribution. As oil prices go up, food costs will too. And what's happening to population? Well, we will have, as we know, even more mouths to feed, and many of those most of those mouths will be in the developing regions. Arable land, well, that's going down per head. And not only that, but there are problems in fast developing countries like China, where they are building on a lot of their arable land, both for housing and for industry. And of course, the other thing that I've not mentioned is that within China and other fast developing countries, they are wanting to eat more meat. And it's very inefficient to convert crop protein to meat protein. You require about seven times more area to do it. So that is going to add to the problem. So for all of these reasons, we have, I think, a major problem expected for food availability in the future. Now, the question is, can GM help? It's a new technology, so can it help? Its critics would say it's not helped yet, and I think I wouldn't completely agree with that, but I would to a large extent. And the major reason is that the crops that have appeared first have not always been concerned with improving yields, although some of them have done that. Its supporters would say, well, it has the potential to help, and that is certainly true. But against that, one can say, well, it's about time we changed the potential to actuality. So I'm going to try to upset most people in the audience today. And to start with, I'm going to ask the question, is organic the answer? Now, actually, I would like to see a situation where organic farmers could make use of GM technology. And I see no scientific reason why that can't be the case. And indeed, organic farmers already use BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, which they apply as a dust. So it's not out of the question scientifically, but it is illegal, at least within Europe. So they won't. And of course, as many of you know, there is a big backlash amongst the organic movement against biotechnology. So is organic the answer? Well, John's kindly referred to the fact that Rothamsted is the oldest agricultural research station in the world. Here's the oldest agricultural field experiment in the world, done on Broadbrook Field. It's been going for over 150 years. And what you can see, I think, is on the right-hand side of the graph that although farmyard manure and conventional fertiliser went together for many years from the 1850s, during the 1970s, after we got new short straw varieties, after we got herbicides and fungicides, now we find that the best fertiliser NPK combination is easily outstripping farmyard manure. And there's now quite a big yield difference. And of course, under an organic regime, we wouldn't have, as we do here with farmyard manure, we wouldn't have the herbicides and the fungicides. So in fact, the yield difference would be even greater. And indeed, even the Royal Society of Edinburgh, in which city we are now, of course, they will tell you, the Royal Society of Edinburgh, that they're an older society than the Royal Society. But they believe that organic farming, at least within the UK, is not sustainable. And Tony Travis has estimated that conventional farm produces about 30 to 40% more in yield than organic. So, is organic the answer to our future major food shortages? And I think the answer is no. And I realise this is controversial. I think a wholesale switch to organic farming would actually condemn billions to starvation. We would need to farm marginal land, which would itself reduce biodiversity. And I realise that there's many eco-theological arguments now that stress, and it's right to stress sustainability, and the move to organic might be more sustainable. But I think the world population that it would sustain would be one that would only be a fraction of the current projected levels. So that's why I question if that is, it may appear at first sight to be on the stewardship principle, a Christian response. I'm not sure it would be. Now, there are risks of GM crops, and we look at those, as I'm going to explain, within Europe, and indeed many people in the US, particularly the companies, think that the European risk assessment procedure is very slow and cumbersome, but I hope you would agree it was thorough. And we look at food safety per se. We also look at the molecular characterisation of the inserted genes and look to see what effect that will have on food safety. We look at genetic effects like gene flow between one species and a closely related, maybe weedy species, or between crop to crop. We look at indirect ecological effects, such as we did in the UK farm scale evaluations. We don't look at the socio-economic or bioethical issues. And the organisation that is charged with looking at each application to grow or import as food or feed any GM food in or crop into Europe is the European Food Safety Authority. And I recently joined, last year I joined the expert panel, and they've got several expert panels, this one's on GMOs. Now, it's a panel of independent academics, and I want to stress that because often you hear it said that scientists are in the pocket of industry. That's certainly not the case for this group of people. And I've been immensely impressed by the care that they take in risk assessment and by how much of their own time they put in. In fact, the chap sitting over here is Marco Nuti of Italy. He said, "Oh, you're going on to the panel, I'm coming off it." I said, "Oh, that's well done. And how much time do you think it took?" He said, "I think it took about 50% of my work time. Far more than really we ought to be putting into it. It's an important area. There's much controversy, and I really believe that the science that is done is very good. We have to liaise with member states. So the member states, if they have queries about GM, problems with the applications, they send them in, and the whole thing is very transparent. All those queries have to be answered in published opinions. Here is, I've just tried to give you an indication of the size of one dossier. It comes in a big paper box to my, I think the postman got a bad back after delivering this. You've got six very thick A4 ring binders of evidence. So much so it doesn't fit onto one CD. I'm just trying to give you an idea of now, I think, that the level of the science that goes into risk assessment. And I think that's important. It's important because it puts into context the difference between us in the EU and our North American friends. Here's a timeline. We won't go into it all, but broadly what happened was that soon after North America started eating GM food, EU consumer pressure stopped the process within Europe of approval through the regulatory process. In fact, in 2002, the US claimed to the World Trade Organization that the EU had imposed a de facto moratorium, and recently the WTO upheld that. What happened in the meantime was that the UK had its own field trials, decided to approve one of them, one out of three, but the company withdrew that variety. And then the European Food Safety Authority was set up to supplement all the work being done in each member state and to coordinate a response. So far it's assessed 10 dossiers as safe. It's a very slow process because of the time it takes. Another more than 25 are still under consideration. But the EU has approved none of the ones that have been assessed as being safe. And that's because this whole process is dependent upon not just science, but also politics. And in fact, a recent USDA report said, I think rightly, that few of the contentious issues now confronting the EU are related to human health and environmental safety. It's highly politicised. Now, I've not put much theology in this talk, partly because I've only just arrived in the vineyard and it would be a bit arrogant for me to do so otherwise. But if you're interested, there is some in this paper that I wrote in 2003 on genetically modified crops. And I looked at mainly at three questions. Is GM wrong because of God's function as creator? In other words, should we do it at all? I thought it was okay to go ahead. Is it compatible with environmental stewardship and with justice to the poor? So that's a question. If we are going to do it, how should we do it? I have mixed feelings on that and still do. I don't think there's anything about GM, the technology, which renders it inevitably incompatible with either of those two. We do need to take great care as a society, maybe greater care than we have done, to ensure that it is compatible with those two. And the third thing I looked at was truth. It's a very controversial area, very many stranded area. And we need, I think, to be very careful about how we present what we believe. And indeed, I think one of the problems that we faced, one of the differences between the US and the EU response, has been that we have had a many-stranded response which has been partly hysterical. We have certainly mixed a lot of different things up. We've mixed up bioethical questions like this, should we be doing it, and if so, how should we do it, with other questions of safety and science. And there's been a fair bit of dubious science as well. I'd very much like this to be unpicked, and I hope I can show you why now. When I look at... and the reason I'm going to dwell on this is because if I'm right and food security is going to be a big issue, food availability is going to go down in the future, this is going to be a very important question for Europe, whether or not they're going to accept the technology. And it's a question we may have to face all over again. So, looking at the Christian Aid website, various statements. So I've got the statements and then I've got my response to them in the boxes. And the first statement concerns world hunger. Christian Aid is saying that golden rice is an example of how GM crops could feed the world. I don't think it is. I think golden rice is an example of how we can use GM crops to develop to deliver to help to those who may need help in overcoming vitamin A deficiency. And they make the point that the world currently produces enough food for everyone. So why do we need GM? And Derek Burke, past president of CIS, has already addressed this. And he says, yes, that's correct. But, he says, it seems perverse to me to walk away from a potential increase in the world's food supply. The next thing I noticed was that GM crops have environmental and health risks that outweigh any alleged benefits. No evidence. GM life forms create the pollution you can never put back. This is use of very flowery language. And that the science is imprecise and relies on the company's own research. I don't accept this. The science is not imprecise. It does rely partly on the company's own research, but this is open to scrutiny, and it's not all the company's own research. There's a lot of information, evidence out there in the scientific literature. There are reports, this one at the bottom, from the Royal Society. You can go on the EFSA website, European Food Safety Authority website. You can look at the guidance document to show how risk assessment is done. You can look at each of the opinions, and they're quite thick, and they go into the science in great detail. They state that many GM crops are designed to withstand greater pesticide use with attendant health risks. We've seen with BT insecticides, I think the reverse is the case, and there's evidence down there to back that up. And then they say GM crops hand even more control over food production to corporations. That may be the case, or it may not be the case, and we'll see later some examples where it's not the case. They call for labelling. I'm in favour of labelling. If something's GM, I think it should be labelled, and I think that consumers should have the choice. But I can't see the point of labelling food from animals fed GM, because there is no technology that would allow you to detect whether or not any food you have. If I had one food from animals that have been eating GM, another food from animals that haven't, there's no way I could detect which one's which, so I can't actually see the point then of labelling it. I don't think there's any food safety implication. And again, you can read the evidence. Again, another Christian organisation, Christian Ecology Link, their stated concerns, possible allergic reactions. Again, every opinion has a section on allergies. There are no more problems with GM than there are with conventional foodstuffs. In both cases, we have to take care. Use of antibiotic resistance genes. Again, this I don't believe is a problem, although I do accept the fact that it's unwise to use them in the future, and they have been withdrawn in the future. And then there is science. Well, I'm not sure you could call it science. The stuff about the viral promoter sequences, I think it's really scaremongering, and it's been now addressed. So the toxins leaching out into the soil, well, the 10 cited references this decade to papers in the refereed literature to show that there are no problems there. So, and I think actually in this case, we can see that a very postmodernist view is being taken by Christian Ecology Link. And I'm not sure that, although they claim their approach is not anti-science, I'm not sure that that is a valid claim. So, although this is a controversial statement to make, I would like to ask the challenge those Christian organisations to look again at the science. What they say may have been true, or I don't think it was true, the basis for what they said, they could have had reasons to have those ideas 10 years ago, maybe. That's being charitable, I think. But certainly not now, 10 years on. So I'd like them to look again at what they've got on the website and review it and try to separate the bad science from the good, and indeed try to be upfront about where they're coming from. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say the way they're being delivered at the moment, GM crops are not fulfilling our need to feed the hungry. So I'd like these strands to be disentangled. And because no talk's a really good talk unless it upsets everybody in the room, now let's go on to the companies. How do they do? Not very well. Because I'm certainly not wanting to support them either in many of the functions that they have. I think they tend to support gene patenting, which I think many of us regard as a theft of life, which belongs to God. It's not ours to buy or sell. The next one down was, I think, more stupidity than malice. They produced the first group of products, no perceived benefit to the consumer. But they have, particularly with regard to the herbicide tolerant trait, I think they have, when I've spoken to them in meetings, they've shown a willful lack of understanding of the effect that HT systems can have on biodiversity on the soil seed bank in agroecosystems. They have an ethos that is not feeding the hungry. Well, you can say, nor do Nokia or Microsoft. So, you know, why are you having a go at them because of that? Well, maybe I'm having a go at them because there's something special about food, isn't there? And many people do worry about the concentration of too much power to control our food supply in the hands of very few large multinationals. Now, in their defence, one thing they might come back at me and say was, well, the reason that there are very few of us is that it's very expensive for us to to get our products approved within Europe because of your very cumbersome risk assessment regulatory procedures. Costs us millions. Well, there is truth in that, but obviously there is a balance. They have bullied individuals over IPR. I have nothing against IPR. I can see that if you've got you put years of investment, you deserve a return for that. But the Schmeiser case, I think, was let's be charitable and say it was bad publicity for them. And they support the narrowing of seed diversity, which I don't think is good for our future. Now, so I've had a go at the companies, and you might think, oh, that's awful. Well, the next thing is diametrically opposed to it, and I think it might be even worse. This slide is by a Templeton Prize winner. Now, he is saying, he's making a prediction. Okay, we used to have computers in big buildings with air conditioning, now you've got them on your desks. They used to be centralised, now they're in your homes. And he's saying maybe the same thing's going to happen to biotechnology, which will become domesticated and get into the hands of housewives and children, and finally will lead to biotech games, and kids will be growing cactuses or dinosaurs. And he says these games will be messy and possibly dangerous. You bet they'll be dangerous. Rules and regulations will be needed. The dangers of biotechnology are real and serious. Thanks for reminding us of that, Freeman. Yeah. This I find quite horrifying, but who knows? He may be right. After considering that, you might not worry too much about the companies, because at least We've got proper regulatory procedures in place, and I think that's the key to this area. Proper regulatory procedures, transparency and good science. Now, I've had a go at various things like organic. You might ask me, well, all right, you know, what would you do? Surely there is a role for stewardship. Yes, there is a role, and I think it's here. And I think it comes in combining biological control, using nature wisely, things like beneficial insects, combining that with our knowledge of conventional agriculture. That's being done in the States, it's also being done here, where our new EU policies are giving rise to subsidies for the environment rather than subsidies for production. In a situation of increased food problems availability, I hope that won't go by the by. I've only got five more minutes, so I'm going to... I've got 3 minutes, so I'm going to rush through this and just look at some of the further issues. Golden rice, produced, will be given free of charge to subsistence farmers. A good example of how public-private partnerships can deliver what we all would see as being good biotech, I hope. Let's not forget that there are many instances of GM research going on universities and research institutes all over the world, particularly in the developing world. Here's another example, Rockefeller Foundation funded. Local solutions, that's key. I was asked to look at the frontiers. What about the new traits that are coming up? From Pioneer, they are promising some of the what we've already had, but also increased yield, nitrogen utilisation, improved nutrition and healthier oils, similar stuff from Monsanto, who at least admit that the first generation of products did not benefit the consumer. Now they're trying to benefit farmer and consumer and processor. Expected towards the end of the decade. GM animals? Big problem here, I think. I won't go into this in any detail, but the problem could be that even if they are sterile, the indirect ecological effects could involve out-competing native species. Although here, the message probably is each has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis, and what you see in the lab may not be what you see in the wild, according to this article in New Scientist that says maybe the problem won't be quite as bad as we thought. It clearly needs much care. Likely future GM issues, my last slide. Gene stacking is already going on, where instead of looking at one trait, the companies are seeking approval for stacking several genes together in a crop. We need to look at GMHT, coexistence between conventional GM and organic. We need to look carefully at farming, particularly when this farming involves using food crops rather than non-food crops. There may be human exposure to GM biofuel crops. Gene silencing may come about in the future, and also I think there are major problems with the risk assessment of GM trees. So there I will stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe, very much. Before that question, I'm going to ask for a point of clarification. You said the EU had not approved any crops, but actually six EU countries are currently growing BT corn. Spain has got 60,000 hectares.
Yeah, I meant since 2004.
Okay. But
so there were nine that were approved, mainly on the basis of existing use prior to that.
Yeah, okay, thanks. There's a question at the back first.
Thank you, Joe. I don't know if you've read the preface to Jurassic Park, but I often quote it to my science students at various points during my secondary school teaching. A quote came earlier about physics community sharing in the responsibility for sin from the World War II development of the atom bomb. And I wonder if you have some thoughts to offer on the worries that we might have, not at all for any GM developments, say even in the next 20 years, but the potential for what might be released an ilk with the atom bomb and its effects on the environment and the planet in which we rely, if biotech is able to get out of regulation and control because it's released to be done by anybody and anywhere.
I think it's important to understand what the risks are, to study what could possibly happen, to study gene transfer between species and their close relatives. And it's also important to put all this into context. I think one of the major... I do share your concerns. I think a lot of your concerns have to do with, well, what about the unknown unknowns? I can't answer those, because unless you tell me what it is that you're concerned about, and this is a problem in risk assessment, I can only say that I think ecologically we have problems. We often have problems with alien invading species like Japanese knotgrass that we get from our garden centres. And so we need to put it into context. We do need to regulate this technology. We have a duty of care for the creation. I accept that. We do need to regulate it thoroughly. And I share some of your concerns.
Okay, thanks. Can we keep questions brief, please? There's one right here, and then there's one there and one there. And that may be all we've got time for, but please keep the questions short.
Nigel Cameron referred to the democratic participation in the decision-making process vis-à-vis human biotech, but yet your technological risk assessment paradigm is entirely done by technical experts, and you've said that they are apart from or opposed by the community, the non-technical community. How do you democratize that process?
That's a really good question, because I think scientists, particularly in agriculture, have suffered a loss of faith by the general public. They've looked at events like, in our country, like BSE, foot and mouth, salmonella, and they have said, you've got it wrong in the past. How do we know you're getting it wrong now? You've appeared to be siding with industry in the past. And I think the only answer to this is improved transparency, good science, using the refereed literature, not the grey literature, but using, basing your arguments upon good science in refereed journals, and a greater transparency. Now, the European Food Safety Authority has been accused of being non-transparent in the past. It is now trying to get its act cleaned up. But I think we could do still more. I'm not sure I would go to the point of saying, well, let's get the TV cameras in while we're having meetings, because scientists make mistakes. You know, we're fallible. Christians, even the non-Christians are fallible.
So they say.
And we make mistakes. And so, you know, we inch towards the truth slowly. Whether or not it would improve public confidence if they saw all of the arguments over this word and that word that we have in committee, I don't know. But I think transparency is a good thing that will help this issue.
Okay, two more quick questions. One there and then one there. So one here first and then one there. As I say, please keep them short.
Thank you very much, Hodges. I just wanted a quick question about potentials. We know that the potentials for the consumer have not yet arrived, and they lie as hopes for the future, for developing countries particularly. But I also would like to ask a question about potentials in science. We know that the GM crops which have been produced so far are all what are called first generation. which means that they have one single gene transferred into a species which is able to provide resistance to herbicides or insecticides. But we know that in the laboratories, particularly at the multinationals, second and third generation products are now being produced or are being researched. And these aim to change metabolism, aim to change immunological systems in plants and in animals, and aim to change physiology.
I wonder if you reached the question.
Yes, so the question really is, with all those complications coming with second and third generation, the potentials for risk are much greater. So my question really is not for you to answer, but to act upon. Would you, representing us as a scientist on the EU Safety Committee, please ensure that that Safety Committee thinks about the potential molecular risks that are going to come in the future, which will be more difficult to assess?
Thanks.
Yes is your answer, Joe, isn't it?
Yes.
one last question right here. Is there a mic there?
I'd like for you to examine the question from the farmer's standpoint. Is there really a gain for the farmer when yields increase and prices drop, which can happen in the United States? And then in the United States, low prices can be alleviated by export to other countries. But then that causes a problem for farmers in other countries if other countries adopt these methods. Will it be necessary for everyone in, say, a third world country to adopt the same technologies? Otherwise, if you're the one that's not, then you're the one that produces less and you're driven out. So I'd like to know how you would view those from the farmer's standpoint.
Yeah. Technology push on the poor, isn't it?
I've just got enormous sympathy with farmers. I'm not an agricultural economist. I have had a lot of contact with farmers over the last 10 years within the GM debate, and have generally found them to be very reasonable people and nice people, and I just feel a great empathy with them, particularly in our country when many of them are going to the wall, both in arable and mixed. And they've got enormous problems, but I haven't got any solutions. So maybe we should just continue to pray for them.
That's a very good point to which to end. Joe, thank you very much indeed.